For the great medieval Talmudist, mystic, and philosopher Nachmanides, the ultimate downfall of the house of the Hasmoneans was linked to their joining the high priesthood and political rulership, which began with Shimon taking on the trappings of royalty. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 49, The Maccabees and the Throne of David. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. All unhappy families are unhappy in their own way, so Tolstoy tells us. And the Bible gives us many portraits of unhappy families. But in the Second Temple period, we suddenly meet a family that fights not with each other, but together against the enemies of Israel. The story of the sons of Mattathias is striking for many reasons, but perhaps above all because of the loyalty that they show one another, as well as the loyalty that they show the legacy and memory of their father. This family togetherness, however, would last only one generation. And as we study how this unity disappeared, we must ponder the lessons left for us about the symbolism of those that are meant to rule from Jerusalem. As we saw yesterday with the defeat of the Greek leader Trypho, Shimon the Maccabee achieved independence for Jerusalem, becoming not only high priest, but royal ruler. He is not called king, but royalty he becomes nonetheless. Thus the Book of Maccabees describes how the Jews proclaimed, quote, Shimon and his descendants as their leaders and high priests, until a true prophet appears. Shimon shall govern their country, have charge of the temple, and shall be their military commander. He shall be in charge of military supplies, fortifications, and public works. The people must obey him in everything. All government contracts shall be drawn up in his name. He shall have the right to wear royal robes, end quote. Shimon the Maccabee was the first independent ruler of Jerusalem in the Second Temple era, and it must therefore have seemed that a golden age was at hand. Shimon was blessed with several sons, and he must have assumed that his dynasty would long endure. But treason was brewing from within the most unexpected place, his own family. Shimon's son-in-law, who strikingly was known by the Greek name Ptolemy, assassinated Shimon and attempted to wipe out all of his in-laws. Ptolemy succeeded in capturing two of Shimon's sons, as well as Shimon's wife, but failed to capture or kill Shimon's third son, known as Yochanan Hyrcanus, or John Hyrcanus. From the way Josephus describes the story, it seems as if Ptolemy had long been an unpopular figure with Jerusalem's Jews. Writing of Shimon's death, Josephus tells us, quote, Now he was the ruler of the Jews in all 8 years, but at a feast came to his end. It was caused by the treachery of his son-in-law Ptolemy, who caught also his wife and two of his sons and kept them in bonds. He also sent some to kill John, the third son, whose name was Hyrcanus. But the young man, perceiving them coming, he avoided the danger he was in from them, and made haste into the city, Jerusalem, as relying on the goodwill of the multitude, because of the benefits they had received from his father, and because of the hatred the same multitude bare to Ptolemy. So that when Ptolemy was endeavoring to enter the city by another gate, they drove him away, as having already admitted Hyrcanus. End quote. Thus did Yochanan Hyrcanus, John Hyrcanus, succeed his father Shimon, as leader in Jerusalem, with his mother and brothers still held captive by his brother-in-law Ptolemy, who had holed up in his own fortress. Josephus again, quote, So Ptolemy retired to one of the fortresses that was above Jericho, which was called Dagon. But Hyrcanus, having taken the high priesthood that had been his father's before, and in the first place propitiated God by sacrifices, he then made an expedition against Ptolemy. And when he made his attacks upon the place, in other points he was too hard for him, but was rendered weaker than he by the commiseration he had for his mother and brethren, and by that only. For Ptolemy brought them upon the wall, and tormented them in the sight of all, and threatened that he would throw them down headlong, unless Hyrcanus would leave off the siege. End quote. The new ruler of Jerusalem, in other words, seeing his family at the mercy of this wicked man, was weakened, and thought to withdraw. And at this point, Josephus recounts, Yochanan Hyrcanus' own mother pleaded from the wall that he, Yochanan, proceed with the attack. Quote, However, his mother spread out her hands and begged of him that he would not grow remiss on her account, but indulge his indignation so much the more, and that he would do his utmost to take the place quickly in order to get their enemy under his power, and then to avenge upon him what he had done to those that were dearest to himself. For that death would be to her sweet, though with torment, if that enemy of theirs might but be brought to punishment for his wicked dealings to them. Now when his mother said so, he resolved to take the fortress immediately. But when he saw her beaten and torn to pieces, his courage failed him, and he could not but sympathize with what his mother suffered, and was thereby overcome. End quote. Thus did Yochanan Hyrcanus fail to conquer Ptolemy's fortress, and he lost his mother and brother in the process. Josephus adds another detail that is worth mentioning, and that is that as the battle stretched on, the Shemitah year began, the seventh year in the biblical agricultural cycle, a year dedicated as a Sabbath for the land, in which the land lies fallow and the farmers refrain from work. Josephus notes that this also prevented mobilization sufficient to overcome Ptolemy, quote, "And as the siege was drawn out into length by this means, that year on which the Jews came to rest came on. For the Jews observe this rest every seventh year, as they do every seventh day. So that Ptolemy being for this cause released from the war, he slew the brethren of Hyrcanus and his mother." End quote. What we see from this description is an entire reversal of the story of the Hasmonean house and a terrible sign of things to come. Before, it was family that was at the heart of Hasmonean strength. The sons of Mattathias fought together, defended each other, and following the death of one in battle, another succeeded in leadership. Here, at the precise moment when power was attained, the threat came from within the family. Yes, it was a son-in-law, but as we shall see in the generations that followed, brothers also turned against brothers. Moreover, as we have also seen, the Sabbath was once so bound up with the battles between the Maccabees and their enemies. And now, on the Sabbath of the land of Israel, the Hasmonean's own family was slaughtered by an enemy within. From a providential perspective, one cannot help but wonder why a family that up till this point achieved such wondrous victories in battle and experienced so many miraculous moments would suddenly experience such ruin. For the great medieval Talmudist, mystic, and philosopher Nachmanides, the ultimate downfall of the house of the Hasmoneans was linked to their joining the high priesthood and political rulership, which began with Shimon taking on the trappings of royalty. It was the patriarch Jacob who, surrounded by his sons at his deathbed, declared in Genesis that the scepter shall not pass from Judah, and this is understood to be a prediction and declaration of the eternity of the Davidic dynasty. It is to the family of David that the throne of Jerusalem belongs. Thus, for Nachmanides, in the story of the Maccabees, we find in Jerusalem a series of events that had also occurred previously in the past. Great salvation, followed by a leader's forgetting of sacred duty. The independence of Jerusalem achieved by Shimon was a moment when all that had been hoped for during the return from Babylon could actually have been achieved. This would have been the moment to reestablish the Davidic dynasty. For Nachmanides, by seizing power for themselves, by creating a monarchy out of the priesthood, the Hasmoneans were betraying the legacy of David, which up till this point they had done so much to defend. To this, Nachmanides adds another point, that not only should a descendant of David have been crowned, but moreover, it was particularly problematic for a temple priest, a Kohen, to assume the crown of political leadership. Crowning a Kohen, and a Kohen Gadol, a high priest at that, involved for Nachmanides the merging of two identities, two vital institutions that must not be joined. So Nachmanides writes, and we must ponder why this is so. Why can a Kohen not be a king? What is the problem with uniting Keter Kehuna, the crown of priesthood, and Keter Malchut, the crown of kingship? The answer appears to be that these two roles are profoundly important but different from one another. And, in carefully studying the respective laws of each, a contrast between them emerges. The high priest remains in the temple, ensuring his purity as he represents the Jewish people before God. Regarding the high priest, Maimonides informs us, "Ubayit yiyeh muchan b'mikdash." The high priest had his own dwelling place in the temple. "Ukvodo v'tifarto shiyeh yoshev Tamid Bamikdash," and his honor lies in him always dwelling in the temple. "V'lo yetzei el lebeito bilvad," and he only leaves the sacred precincts in order to go home. And Maimonides adds, "V'yeh beito b'Yerushalayim ve'eino zaz misham." The high priest's home ought to be in Jerusalem, which he can never leave. The place of the high priest is in the sacred. The king, however, is commanded by the Torah to write a Torah scroll of his own, one which he takes with him wherever he goes. To this, Maimonides further adds that when the high priest first writes his Torah, he is to bring it to the temple to confirm its validity from the Torah scroll kept by the priests. The symbolism is profound. The king's principles, his Torah, is formed by and always guided by the priests, the safeguarders of the sacred, of the Torah and tradition. But once that Torah is written, it is the king's duty, his unique task, not to stay in the holy, but to go throughout his country, representing the chosen people to all. Both king and Kohen are forms of biblical leadership, but they are different and they are not meant to be merged. Shimon was meant to serve as high priest, but not king. According to Nachmanides, he saw too much. And here another irony reveals itself. Shimon's ancestor Aaron, the first high priest, was known for his striking familial love and loyalty. Thus, when told that his younger brother Moses was chosen as the Redeemer of Israel, Aaron reacted only with joy. After an entire biblical book, that of Genesis, replete from beginning to end, from Cain and Abel to Joseph and his brothers, with story upon story of havoc wreaked upon family life by pride and envy among brothers, Aaron's attitude is the exact opposite. We meet a man who does not define his success by the achievements of others, and who is profoundly glad and grateful for the blessings of God bestowed upon others. The first generation of the Hasmoneans acted akin to their ancestor Aaron. They were full of devotion to each other. But, as we will see, what began in the age of Shimon with an attack by a son-in-law will in another generation become battles between brothers. But even in the midst of all this, as a royal dynasty will emerge from this family, even as it is riven by conflict, the children of Israel will never forget the true King of Jerusalem, which is why, throughout the generations, the memory of David will live still. This is Meir Salavich, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.